Hello, it is July 14th, 2014. You are looking live at Minneapolis, Minnesota. This is episode 4.38 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on sports on earth. And I thank you. I'm Will Leach. I thank you for spending part of your day with me. We are in the second week of the podcast change, the great controversial podcast change of 2014. I apologize again. I know a lot of people like having four or five interviews a week. I loved having four or five interviews a week. I simply did not have time to do all of those. So I do, however, have time to do one interview a week now. I decided to add a trivia thing component onto that, so you would at least have there would at least be the illusion of a regular podcast 5 days a week. Extra Hot Great, which is probably my favorite podcast, does something very similar. But if you don't like that, we can make all the trivia in one day on Tuesday, perhaps, or whichever. So I implore you to either get on Twitter, at William F. Leach, or email me, leach@sportsonearth.com, or yell out your window and let me know which you prefer, either trivia spread out throughout the week or just one big trivia podcast on Tuesday. This week, however, we will be doing Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday as previously put together, because you haven't told me yet, because I'm just recording this now, and you haven't heard it yet, because I'm not even done with the interview. You see how it works. It's a space-time continuum sort of deal. But anyway, so let me know which one you like, but the one thing we will not be able to be doing is going to four or five interviews a week, because I simply do not have time to do it. I would love to do so, but I'm a busy guy. I'm typing, like, constantly. Like, have you guys seen? I write, like, all the time. Anyway, I am in Minneapolis for the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, which is Tuesday, tomorrow night. This will be my third time being in town for All-Star Week, though only my second game. I went to the Busch Stadium in 2009, and then went to Citi Field last year, made it through all the festivities. I even went to the Futures game. And then by the time I was at FanFest doing some sports on Earth panel with Jonathan Bernhardt and Emma Spann, and I was literally so exhausted at the end of it, I just went to my hotel and went to bed. So I did fall asleep watching the game, you know, because I'm a reporter. Anyway, I will be, despite the fact that I have a newborn I'm still recovering from sleep, I will be at the game tomorrow. But I'm here all week, until Wednesday anyway, for the Major League Baseball All-Star Game, which is fun. I love the All-Star Game. But as is our tradition, as last year, if you remember, we had Joe Sheehan on. He is the writer of the Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter, which if you are not subscribing for, you are only depriving yourself of a life-changing experience. He is probably the smartest mind on baseball I know, and we are going to our yearly chat about the world of baseball at the All-Star break. I think today is the day that Bud Selig does his State of the Game press conference. We're going to do it. We're going to talk about the state of the game with Joe, who I think sometimes differs from the commissioner on several things. So we're going to chat with Joe, and then please do remember to tell me which podcast format you prefer. All right, and now time for Joe. All right, Joe, first off, thank you for coming back on with me. This is one of my favorite podcasts of the year, to do the State of the Game podcast with you. So thanks for coming on.
No, always good to talk to you, Will, and I want to say congratulations on your happy news.
Oh, well, you know, right now it doesn't feel very happy because the baby doesn't know what night and day it is. So right now, all that exists is screaming and pain, and like he's asleep for an hour and then up and yelling. This you forget. The only reason anyone ever has a second child is they forget what it's like. but thank you. Now let's go on to happier, less groggy things. All right, so one of the things I like to talk to you about, you know, because, you know, Bud Selig always does his big State of the Game press conference over All-Star Week. I think it's today, as a matter of fact. I don't think I'll be going, but I'm sure I'll watch it. And there are tons of reporters that will tell me what happens. This is his last one. So, you know, I like to talk to you because you're one of my favorite baseball writers and know, and I feel like have a pretty strong, pretty well-backed up thoughts on the state of the game. I want to talk to you about some major issues going on in baseball right now and kind of how you think they're going, what we could do to fix them or resolve them. And then I want to wrap up with a big what we talk about when we talk about Selig type of moment. So the first thing I want to ask you about, there was much discussion about replay coming into this year, all the worries about it. There's still... They resolve. I thought it was a little weird that they I'm glad they did it, that they did the take the ball out of the glove thing, but it still feels weird to change a rule in the middle of the year. Generally speaking, how do you think replay's going? Is it fixing what we wanted to fix?
I think replay has been a success, and I think most of the problems people have with replay are in this particular implementation of replay, in that because of the challenge system, there's a lot of dead time where we see managers come out and then don't challenge a play because it has to be relayed through the bench, through the guy in charge of replay, through the bench coach, and then out to the manager. So it's the implementation that's caused a lot of the delays. I agree with you that it's strange to change a rule in season as they did with the exchange rule, but I think it was much better to do that than to go 5 more months of these ridiculous situations where clear catches were being ruled as drops. I think that would have been a greater farce. And we've also seen them have to rethink the blocking the plate rule. There was an out change into a save call on a force play. And they went and said, okay, well, that we never intended for that to happen, so they fixed that as well. And I actually give the powers that be credit for having the flexibility to say, hey, look, this is a work in progress. Things are going to come up organically within a game that we really haven't planned for. There was a continuity play in Oakland, I want to say about 3 weeks ago, where the players acted based on the umpire's call. When the call was changed, the player's actions were then subsequently rendered void. A force play was turned into a tag play. And they've got to go back and fix that to say, okay, the players have to be beholden to the rule on the field. So there are things that are going to continue to come up in this first year of replay, and really probably in the second and third year, because you only know what you need to correct after you've seen the problem happen. But I think the game has done a very good job at implementing replay. I think that the reactions to some of the special cases have been good. I will say that the one thing I'd like to see them go to, and I believe that we will eventually get there, is eliminating the challenge system and going to a fifth umpire, whether it's in the booth or in New York, who has the power to overrule the call on the field. Instead of reviewing plays, only plays that are challenged, we're going to review every single play, in part because I think you need to take. Right now, plays are challenged based on someone having an incentive to have the play changed. The manager wants the play changed. I think eventually we've got to get to the play gets challenged because the umpire has the incentive to get the play right.
Yeah, it is funny because the challenges seem kind of unnecessary. The actual number of challenges seem kind of unnecessary now, because really the same thing happens every time there's a close play. The camera cuts to the manager. The manager looks like he looks, that's curious. Glances over on the phone, walks slowly out to the umpire, and it's weird because and by the time if they get there and they've received word, nope, don't challenge. It's not a challenge, and it. And I tend to not mind. I think it's kind of strange, actually. Ordinarily, we're in the position where players and people inside the game like something, and we don't. It's the opposite this time because I feel like a lot of players. You hear them complaining about the replay system a lot. Announcers, certainly, nobody complains more about the replay system than broadcasters because they have to fill airtime. But generally speaking, the issues seem to be just with that kind of process. And you wonder if that's a 1 year thing, like you wonder, or a 2 year thing. If in 2 years they're like, you know what, maybe the thing that fixes this and makes this go faster is just having that little button in New York. Because I feel like once you have the system in New York, and I've seen it, it's amazing. Once you kind of have that system in New York, which is something we'd always been calling for, everything else is just kind of details that we just have to figure out. But I feel like now that the system exists, we'll never go back from it.
Yeah, once we've crossed the Rubicon into replay, improving replay becomes a lot easier. Jumping from nothing to this was a much bigger move than any move that will come subsequently. So I think we'll eventually get there. I don't, if it's not next year, it's the years to follow. But as you say, the replay delays, you see these numbers, there have been X number of challenges, X number of overturns taking, Y time. But it isn't counting for the dead time with the non-challenges. And there are probably at least one and up to maybe three, four in every game. That's adding a lot of dead time. Now, I think people aren't seeing, there's also time put back in the game, and that we're not seeing the Lloyd McClendon base throwing rant anymore. And for some people, like, well, they miss that. And I'm like, I don't really miss
Right.
that. In the same way, I wouldn't miss it if we stopped throwing at baseballs at batters' heads. There are just certain ridiculous, grown men in pajamas yelling at grown men in business wear is just silly. So I'm happy to see the ridiculous arguments go away. And again, that's time that's put back in the game. But I am very encouraged by what's happened with replay, not just for how it's worked this year, but for what it implies about future improvements and eventually getting to the best possible system.
Yeah, and I will. It is funny too because there is. It's strange. Managers really don't get angry anymore. They just cut. They all. It's in one way. I kind of like it because it's almost they've become middle managers. Like they've become communicators in a lot of ways when it comes to the replay stuff. Because basically, that's it. Is I've seen that. I'm curious. Look on every manager's face at least 100 times this year because the camera immediately goes to them anytime there's a close call. It'd be nice to get that resolved. And you know, another thing I feel like was unnecessary. I've talked to a couple people that work at MLB about this. I think it's hilarious that I like the transparency. I think they're almost going over the top with the transparency of the calls. Like MLB.com runs a story with every call that's overturned, and I think the fact that I think it's a pretty good sign that it's working. That it's working at least in the general way the way it's supposed to. That such a large number of calls are overturned. You know, we saw. I mean, when they presented all this to all the reporters that I was with at the time in the booth, they said they expected I think it was 99% of calls were correct anyway, and the number ones that and it turned out there's a higher percentage of calls that have been overturned than they expected, but that's only because of this little dance that everybody makes before they challenge a call. So I'd be happy to get rid of the challenge system. Plus, it gets us farther away from football, and I think anytime you could do that.
Yeah, I mean, we're only challenging the marginal calls.
Right.
So umpire basically calls that are coin flips on the field. So, and I think it's something like, and I'm going to make up numbers that are broadly correct. I think it's like 25% overturned, 50% too close to call, and 25% confirmed. Well, that means that, you know, the replay is only backing up the umpires one out of every four times. And that's not the specific numbers. It's something, looks like a bell curve like that.
Right.
Something like that. And I don't know. The other thing, one point I make is players don't really have an opinion on replay. Players don't like it when calls go against them. So the Jose Bautista rant or whoever else had it.
Right.
Players will only complain about it when it goes against them and, oh, the system's terrible. No, you just don't like the outcome of the system. I think the players should be greater stakeholders in certain processes in the game more than they currently are. I think they should have a voice. But when players complain about replay, it's entirely self-interest.
Yeah, Bautista complains about umpire. I mean, he's kind of notorious for complaining about umpires having it in for him anyway before this came around. So maybe he's right. Maybe it's specifically Bautista. But other than that, all right. So I want to move on to something you've written very eloquently about, and I think there's something to be whether it is or it is not a problem. But it's undeniably happening, and that is the massive increase in strikeouts. This is turning into a strikeout dominant game, and you know we've looked at. One of the reasons why, you know, pitching specialties. I always kind of feel like this is actually tied into arm injuries for pitchers. In that, you know, when I wrote my big arm injury story for New York Magazine a couple of years ago, basically everyone I talked to said, yeah, the reason there are more injuries now is not because our medicine has gotten worse, it's gotten so much better. It's just we encourage people to throw like crazy, and throw as hard as they can, and that's really, really bad for your arm. And therefore, but because of that, you know, we're getting these strikeouts and we're making a larger part of the game. Do you think A, that the increased number of strikeouts is bad for the game? And B, if you do think it is, how can we fix it or should we fix it?
Excuse me. I think that we've reached a point where the increase in strikeouts is starting to be bad for the game. We crossed over to where about one in every five plate appearances in a game is a strikeout. And in the late innings, it's closer to one in every four. And that's where you really start to notice how little action is happening, how few balls in play are being hit. And certainly it's had an effect on base percentage, on run scoring, in small combination with the increase of impact of shifts and in large combination with the larger strike zone that's being called. Pitchers are striking out more batters than they ever have while walking almost near all-time lows in terms of percentage. We're sort of got all-time strikeout rates and near all-time low walk rates, and that's an incredible combination when you've got all these pitchers throwing harder. I feel, and I want to make it very clear here that I'm talking about Joe Sheehan's opinion as opposed to what, you know, is right and is wrong objectively.
Okay.
I believe the game is less entertaining in its current form than any version of baseball that I've gotten to watch. So you go back to what run scoring, the run scoring levels now are roughly what they were in 1992, before the offensive explosion that started in 93 and ran to about 2008. But that game back then had a lot more balls in play and a lot more base running, a lot more doubles and triples relative to what we have now. What we have now, the shape of the game right now, is effectively the baseball that was played in 1968 with more strikeouts and more home runs. Home runs, as a measure, as measured by when a bat hits a ball, by contact, aren't that much different than what they were at the during the quote-unquote so-called steroid era. There was a peak from 98 to 2001, and then outside of that, we're roughly in the same era. So what we have now is a game that's dominated not by three true outcomes, strikeout, walks, and homers, but by two true outcomes, strikeouts and home runs. It's a stagnant game. You are less likely to see a single, a base hit, the fundamental unit of baseball, at a baseball game now than at any time in history. The dead ball era, second dead ball era, any time ever, you are less likely to see a single. And we're about 2 years away, at current paces, from strikeouts being more common than hits of any stripe. I feel like this is where the Rubicon gets crossed. Baseball should be a game. If you go back 150 years, baseball was, the pitcher wasn't supposed to do anything but put the ball in play, like a softball pitcher, or a slow pitch softball pitcher, I should say. And now it's the pitcher is the most the pitcher is going to be the most important guy in the field. I can understand that, but between increased velocity, development of pitches like the cut fastball, strike zones, hitters are just overmatched. They are just completely overmatched. And yes, this is potentially related to the increase in arm injuries that we've seen. I did a very small, very basic study about 2 months ago that found that starting pitchers who averaged 95 miles per hour on their fastball, and this is over the last 10 years, were something like 50% more likely to undergo Tommy John surgery than pitchers who threw 94 or 93. Very basic. I'm not even going to pretend it's hard science. Nate Silver probably could find 17 things wrong with it. But there did seem to be some kind of correlation between throwing 95-plus and getting hurt. It may be. We used to worry 20 years ago about innings pitched, pitch counts really more so than innings pitched. And we eliminated the 150-pitch outings, 140-pitch outings, 130-pitch outings. Now, pitcher usage in terms of pitcher abuse, the way we used to talk about it, has basically been eliminated. But the trade-off has been this increase in velocity that seems to be also leading to injury. So do I know what the solution there is? I honestly don't. I don't think you can tell pitchers, well, throw 93, but don't throw 95. Because, well, everybody likes money because it can be used to buy things. This is how we evaluate pitchers. Scouts will notice command, control. Every now and then, Danny Hulson will be drafted second, and people will scratch their heads. But what gets you money, what gets you paid, is how hard do you throw. And I don't know if that's going to change. So the incentives down to being a 12-year-old kid in Texas are lined up to have you throw as hard as possible. I'm not sure how you break that cycle.
And isn't this kind of a result of the game just becoming almost more efficient? This is born down to its essence. There's nothing more predictable than a strikeout. So if you can get strikeouts, then you can control a lot of other things. And I think that's what that I think this is the result of that. It bothers me a little less than it bothers you, but I absolutely understand why it's kind of a dangerous trend moving forward.
Well, it's evolution, unquestionably. In the same way that the NBA game has evolved into three pointers and dunks, because smart guys figured out this was the best way to win. And football, the running game has disappeared to football because smart guys figured out that throwing the ball was the best way to win. This is the way baseball has evolved now. And this is a very important point. A lot of people still focus on hitters. Well, if hitters would just have a two-strike approach, or if hitters would just make contact. Now, I think there was probably a time where that was true. If you go back to even as recently as like maybe the late 90s, early 2000s, when the three true outcome and the take and rake were really the way the game was played. I think maybe you could have put it a little more on the hitters then. But now I think it's just the pitchers. The pitchers are just overpowering. And it may be that as average pitch speeds tick upwards, and I'm like 20 pitchers average 93, you know, 10 years ago, and now it's like 80 guys. And the average fastball is just, it's 2 miles an hour faster than it was 10 years ago. It's just everything is much faster. And you just start to wonder, have we broken the game of baseball? If pitchers can routinely throw 92, if the average fastball is 92, is it just too much to ask hitters standing 60 feet, 6 inches away with a bat in their hands to hit that pitch effectively? I really do think it's as simple as that. It's as simple as velocity is breaking the dimensions of baseball.
So is there a way to reverse this evolution? I mean, typically those that try to reverse evolution fail or make things worse. But is there a way to make the – how do you fix this? Can you?
The most common suggestion made to me was to move the mound back. And I don't think you can do that for a number of reasons. One, you risk hurting pitchers. And we're already in there where we're hurting a bunch of pitchers. I don't know what it would mean to a pitcher to move a foot back, but I feel like it would have a lot of bad, it would do a lot of bad things to the arm. Because if not, even if you tell these guys it's the same thing, they're going to think, oh, I'm a foot farther back. Plus, what effect does it have on breaking pitches? How do pitchers have to recalibrate? And also, do we rebuild every baseball? It's one thing to say, okay, we're going to rebuild the 30 major league stadiums. Do we rebuild 180 minor league stadiums? Do we rebuild 250 college fields? Do we rebuild 250,000 high school fields? Where does it end? So I don't think that that's a feasible solution. My preferred solution, and this is kind of a – well, forgive me. I get a little bit of a cold. My preferred solution is the strike zone, largely because I think you can implement the solution. It's a roundabout way of getting to the same problem, but – right now, the relationship between – right now, pitchers can throw 92, 93 because they're getting to pitch to what I believe is the largest strike zone I've ever seen. I shouldn't say that. Since about the 88 to 92 period, it's a very, very large strike zone because it's laterally large. If you're a left-handed batter, you're effectively asked to cover about 19, 20 inches because the umpire, home plate umpires now give those 2 to 3 inches on the outside corner. So now you have pitchers throwing hard, throwing cut fastballs, and getting extra lateral inches. I feel like if the rulebook strike zone were called 17-inch wide plate, it would change the relationship between velocity and accuracy for pitchers, command, control, whatever you want to call it, such that it would shift the relationship back in the direction of the hitters a little bit. I'm focusing more on the walk rate, I guess, than I am on the strikeout rate. I think, though, that if you call the rule book strike zone, and yes, that's going to involve calling the high strike a little bit as well, but here's the thing. If you're standing at home plate, picture yourself standing with a bat in your hands, are you more likely to be able to hit a pitch that's up at your letters but over the plate or, you know, in your wheelhouse, say your wheelhouse is your waist or whatever, but 3 inches off the plate? I feel like I'd much rather have the high strike be called and effectively the outside strike be called. So I feel like if we could get a rulebook strike zone called, and my preferred solution is technology, that would at least cause pitchers to have to throw more strikes, more hittable pitches. It would bring down the strikeout rate. It might tick up the walk rate as well. And it would restore a little bit of balance to the batter-pitcher matchup.
And you wonder, you know, going to tie this into replay a little bit, it does feel like the umpires, you know, you still get an ump show every once in a while, but it does feel like that is, I wouldn't say they're being tamed, but it feels like that's a situation that we have a little bit more control over in the age of replay. Would you agree with that? I don't know if you agree with that or not, but if you do that, then you can start being like, okay, here's the strike zone again, guys. So I feel like my instinct when you say that is that, like, hey, that's a great idea. Good luck getting the umpires to go along with it.
Yeah, I umpires can be replaced in a way that players or anybody else really can't. Well, sport trainers, I guess. You're familiar with this new area of study of pitch framing and the impact of pitch framing on
run. Yes.
I haven't written this. I've literally been sitting on this piece for like 18 months, and I hesitate to write it only because it comes off as anti the concept or anti the people who are doing it. It's not. But my fundamental issue with praising pitch framing as a skill is that all it's doing is exploiting a loophole in the game, which is that umpires can't call balls and strikes. Umpires are guessing. And what pitch framing does is basically underlines that by saying umpires aren't calling the pitch when it crosses the plate, they're calling the pitch when it hits the catcher's glove. So I feel like pitch framing and the amount, the spread of abilities in terms of these catchers between Jonathan Lucroy and Ryan Domet is the best argument ever for replacing home plate umpires and calling balls and strikes, for going to technology. I know Corey Schwartz, our friend at MLB Advanced Media, has basically told me the technology isn't there yet, and that's fine. But the second the technology is there, I want to go to it. And frankly, I would just as soon see them go to it before then for this reason. If pitch framing tells us that umpires are basically guessing on marginal pitches, and we know that there are biases, I want to say it's Beyond the Box Score that has done studies on the left-handed bias that I just talked about. I got that from them. I mean, it was, they show you the map of the left-handed strike zone where it's 2 to 3 inches off the plate. They've shown that umpires call 3-0 pitches on the margin strikes. They call 0-2 pitches balls in the same spot. We know all of these biases are in play. I don't want any of those to be in play. I want the bias to be, was the ball a ball or a strike? Did it cross the strike zone or not? And I think the only way we get there is technology. And even if the technology isn't perfect, the baseline isn't perfection. The baseline is the terrible job that home plate umpires do right now. So I think go to technology. You're going to help the strikeout problem. You're going to fix the balance between offense and defense. And frankly, you're going to end this silly idea that you can gain 30 runs a year by not moving your glove. I'm really uncomfortable with the idea that fooling the umpire can be worth 30 runs a year.
Yeah. No. Not that I don't like the idea of a computer throwing out a manager for a arguing balls and strikes. I like that notion.
I'm not trying to fire home plate umpires. You still need them there for any number of reasons. Right. But I got to take this off the record. I don't think the human eye is capable of doing this job. That's been my argument for a long time now. A human eye is not capable of discerning the placement of a 5.25-inch round sphere moving in 3 dimensions at 93 miles per hour through an imaginary box a foot in front of your face. Yeah. It can't be done.
That is very compelling, actually. Okay, this is another topic I want to get into. It feels like they're going to have, there's two more topics, then we'll hit our big C-League talk. One thing that came up this year is law of unintended consequences or circumstances, results, whatever. It's the Stephen Drew, Kendry Morales thing, the idea that, like, the way service time is working now and the way that the free agent and the draft stuff is working. I'm curious, when you look at the way that, like, you saw what the Pirates kind of did with Polanco and what the Astros have been done trying to sign their guys early, is there an issue with the way service time is working right now? Is there a way to resolve it? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, two separate things. One, the compensation for free agents issue with the qualifying offers that eventually affected Morales and Drew and some of these other guys. We call it compensation, and it's not actually anymore. It's punishment. It is punishment for signing free agents because the system that was in place for about 20 years with the Elias rankings and type A, type B, the draft pick that the signing team would lose would go to the team that had lost the player. So it was compensatory. You can sign this free agent, but they're going to get your first-round draft pick. In the new CBA, the two things were separated. The team that signs the free agent loses the pick, but that pick disappears. And the team that lost the free agent gets a sandwich pick. This is an important distinction for me, because to me it underlined the point of these quote-unquote compensation picks all along. They've never really been designed to be compensatory. They've been designed to be punitive. Don't sign free agents. We want to drag down the price of free agents. We don't want you all competing freely for free agents. We want to hurt you for signing free agents. And this new system makes that explicit. You know, you can give, if you wanted to, you could give teams losing a free agent a sandwich pick without touching the team signing the free agent. The only reason to have that system in place now is to hurt free agents. And it's not going to hurt Bobby Cano. God, where'd that come from? Robinson Cano. It's not going to hurt Brian McCann. It's not going to hurt the very best free agents. It's going to crush the Drews and the Moraleses, where it's just not worth it to give up the 13th pick in the draft to sign you. And eventually some team might decide it's worth it, the Orioles with Jimenez. Good job. Good effort, guys. But for the most part, these teams are not going to are these players are going to be hurt by the process. Now, I don't want to get into an MLBPA rant here, but let's just say this is part of a package of decisions that they've made over the last 10 years that have not been in the players' best interests. I don't know how you sit there, negotiate this system, and not realize that you've essentially just you've divorced compensation from the process. It's not compensation anymore. I wish to heck we could get people to stop calling them compensation picks. It's not about compensation. It's about punishing teams for signing free agents. Sign a free agent, lose your first round pick. The other team's not going to get it. So that's that issue there. And I think we'll see balance return. What will happen this year, Will, is after the last 2 years, teams will become more conservative about giving the qualifying offer. Players, if offered, may become a little more realistic about picking it up. I will say this. The only player in this entire process where I would look and go, maybe they should have taken the pick, was Kendry Morales. Maybe they should have taken the qualifying offer, is Kendry Morales. Kendrys Morales. I didn't think Drew was going to hung out to dry the way he was. I really thought 14 was going to be low for him. And, you know, Jimenez eventually got paid. Irvin Santana essentially got the same deal. You know, I think Morales is really the only guy in this whole process where it's like, well, yeah, you probably should have recognized the market. I know people like to pick on Scott Boras. Any kind of a Boras client, something bad happens to a Boras client, people take a lot of glee in that.
Right, right.
And people don't like to recognize just how much money Scott Boras has made for players. And frankly, we should all be represented by Scott Boras. If Scott Boras ever wants to move into representing mediocre baseball writers, I'm going to be first in line.
if he did that, he wouldn't be Scott Boras.
exactly. I can't get I get the Jay Moore from Jerry Maguire, you know, whoever he represents. But no, I think that this is a bad system, but it's working the way the owners want it to work, so therefore they have no incentive to reopen the CBA to fix it. And I do think that we'll just see an organic correction this year. Whoever Kendrys Morales is this year probably won't get a qualifying offer because whoever's team he plays for won't want to be on the hook for potentially accepting it. Service time's a whole different issue. And I think it's important to remember that the system we have today was never the product of everybody sitting down and going, hey, what's the best way to do this? We got arbitration to end holdouts in the early 1970s. We then got free agency because Peter Seitz blew up the landscape. And the six-year thing was kind of a compromise between, hey, everybody can be a free agent this winter, and the reserve clause. So now you've got two completely different systems that work kind of as a feeder thing. You get arbitration rights, and then you get to be a free agent. First it was 2 years, then it went to 3 years, I want to say, after the 81 strike. And then I think it was 85, that two-day strike that they had, they kind of came up with this hybrid system of a certain percentage of players who were between 2 and 3 years of service time would have arbitration rights with a floating number from year to year. Or it's just the same percentage, but the day would change. Now, it took about 20 years for teams to start manipulating this. But that's what we have now with the most notable example this year being Gregory Polanco, who seemed to have been held down just long enough so that he wouldn't be able to go to arbitration until I can do math, after the 2017 season. Now, if you're Gregory Polanco and the Pirates want to sign you to a huge deal, here's what you're looking at. What if you make this year, two-thirds of $500,000? They can renew you for $500,000 next year. They can renew you for $500,000 the year after that. They can renew you for $500,000 in 2017. You're not looking at making real baseball money until early 2000, whenever you start getting your first checks in 2018. And even then, they can go to arbitration. You've got to play well for 3.5 years to get paid. That's a big incentive versus 2.5 years to get paid. It's a big incentive to go ahead and sign this contract. A lot of people didn't like it when, well, Bud Norris didn't like it anyway, when John Singleton signed his big deal.
Right.
I don't think these guys understand just how hard it is to make $10 million in baseball. How easy it is to flame out, especially if you're not a truly elite guy. If you look at the history, I was going to write this up, and I never did, and I'm going to forget who did this. Somebody did this at Fangraphs, I think. Or maybe it was the Hardball Times. Somebody wrote the article. They basically looked at all of the prospects, you know, in the 25 to 75 range, or all of the first base prospects, and compared them and said, how much money did these guys make? And you find that John Singleton locking in $10 million is not a bad deal. The teams have finally figured out that this is the only hammer they have, and they're using it. I don't have a problem with that. These are the rules as designed, and they should exploit them. It's the union's job to look and say, these rules aren't fair to this number of players, and we need to fix them. And the MLBPA hasn't taken an aggressive stance in negotiations since 1998, arguably since 1994. And really, I don't even say aggressive. It's been decades since the players have gone to the bargaining table and pounded their fists and said, we want X. All they've really been saying is, you know, for years now, is the system works. Everybody's making money. Let's go. And they've had givebacks and givebacks and givebacks over the last 15 to 20 years as they've lost all of their leverage. They've lost all of their cohesiveness as a union. Frankly, MLB has taken advantage of that. Players used to get 56, 57% of revenue. They get 43% now. That's a broken system. Not for you or for me, but if you're representing the MLB Major League Baseball Players Association and you've gone from and you've lost a quarter of the money you were making, not in terms of absolute, but in terms of percentage, you're doing your job wrong. And all of these little niggling rules that we're talking about feed into that.
And I want to get back to this after we do our next topic, because I feel like that speaks to one of the major Selig legacy things, which we're going to wrap up with. So put a pin in that, and we'll finish up that as well. So the last thing I want to talk about is the second wild card. You were a, I think quite understandably, quite a critic of the second wild card, if just for the same reason that I was, which is, yeah, so wait, we're actually, the playoffs now could involve just one game on the road. Like, that was my horrible fear for Baltimore a couple of years ago. They waited so long to finally make the playoffs. This could have happened to Pittsburgh if they had not gotten home field and lost to the Reds last year. You wait forever to get the playoffs, then you play a coin flip game, and then you lose. And all of a sudden, wait, was I in the playoffs? Was I not in the playoffs? We've certainly seen now there's, what, maybe five at the All-Star break. There's five, maybe six teams that could legitimately think that they're not gonna make it this year. Everyone else is still just kind of hanging around. It's weird. Like, for a while, the Phillies were still like, that may be their own issue, but they were still kind of believing that the second wild card certainly has kept more teams feeling like they're apart. That's also, of course, really kind of hurt what we're usually excited about in trade season in this time of year. Do you think the second wild card has worked better than you thought it would, worse, or are we still kind of figuring it out?
It's the same thing. Once I kind of define the second wild card as one playoff spot divided among two teams, it kind of just like, okay, whatever. You're playing for one playoff spot. The real playoff spot is the team that gets to play on Thursday or Friday of that week. And the fact that, you know, two teams are going to play for it on Tuesday or Wednesday, okay.
Yeah.
It's one playoff spot divided by two. I guess I just don't consider those two games to really be the playoffs.
Yeah.
That's how I've kind of come around to it. And I also didn't like it because I thought it was a backdoor. Well, again, I do apologize.
You're doing fine.
I thought it was a backdoor way of getting to what they wanted, which is to make the division titles mean something. If you want the division titles to mean something, make them the only path to the playoffs. I would love to see a 16 playoffs. I thought that would have been the perfect solution. You would have gotten September back, and it would have cost you one playoff series. Frankly, it would have cost you the one playoff series nobody ever watches. You know, it's the one that always seems to have, all the games are played at 2:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday.
Yeah, it's the NBA, the series that's on NBA TV. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
So I don't think there would have been a great loss there, but fine. You know, I feel like I've lost the discussion. We're never going back, and I'm okay with that. I will say this. One of my fundamental objections is the possibility of what is actually, I won't say it's likely to happen, but it very much could happen in the American League this year. The most likely, as I sit here right now, AL wild card game is the second and third place teams in the American League West. The A's or the Angels playing the Mariners. Right now, the Angels are 6.5 games ahead of the Mariners. There's every chance that you're going to have the Angels at 96-66 playing the Mariners at 86-76 in a one-game playoff with, let's say it's Felix Hernandez on the mound. Mm-hmm. Because the Mariners have locked up this pick and, you know, they're able to set their rotation for it. The Angels might have to battle the A's down to the wire, and they're going to put C.J. Wilson on the mound. So after finishing 10 games ahead of the Mariners in the regular season, they're going to face a team that, because it wasn't as good as them, got to set its rotation and gets to put one of the three best pitchers in baseball on the mound in a one-game playoff. Essentially, one afternoon could reverse the results of an entire baseball season. This has, by and large, been the nightmare scenario that I've drawn up for this, and it very much could happen this year. I'm saying it will. I mean, we've got 2 months of baseball to play, 2.5 months. Maybe the standings change, maybe the... But the true nightmare scenario is that in one afternoon, the Angels being 10 games better than this other team, in the same division, playing the same schedule, could be invalidated.
Yeah, that is crazy. This is the year that would happen, because right now, at the All-Star break, the Angels are 6.5 games up of Seattle in the wild card, who they're 2.5 up on the Royals and the Blue Jays. And, man, there are a lot of teams still just kind of hanging around. But the Angels are 6 games up, and they're what? They are a game and a half behind the A's. You're right. This is exactly the year that would happen. And Felix would be exactly the pitcher that would happen to. So, yeah, well... Well, that's a good point, but and if that happens, I promise I won't be screaming that Joe was the Cassandra on this, and no one will listen to any of us anyway.
Well, eventually, it's right. If it doesn't happen this year, it's eventually going to happen.
Right.
You're going to have the year where there are two great teams in the league. They're going to finish 1-2 in the division, and it just so happens that the third best team, you know, the second wild card is going to come from that. Just the way the math falls, it's eventually going to. This has always been the argument against, no matter what you expand the playoffs to. You're always going to have, like, this came out of, what was the year the Yankees and Rays punted September, 2008?
Yeah.
This all came out of, you know, these teams don't care about winning the division. Well, I got news for you. They didn't care about the winning the division back in 95 either. I watched the Padres and Dodgers play an exhibition game, tied through 161 games because they didn't care. So once you put the wild card in, this is what you set up. 2008, everybody decided to notice. So after they did this, I said, this is what's eventually going to happen. It will eventually happen, and everybody will get up in arms about it. But probably the likely solution then, well, you know what's coming, right? The third wild card. And you'll have two teams get a bye, and you'll have the third division leader and the three. Well, you'll basically have the NFL playoffs format. So what it was before they realigned. Playoff expansion is inevitable. And frankly, the only reason baseball hasn't expanded its playoffs further than it has is weather. Baseball is the one sport constrained by the weather. So you have a natural end to the season. And unless they go to, 154 games or mandatory doubleheaders, both of which I'd be happy to see, you really are limited as to how far you can expand the playoffs.
Well, eventually they'll have wildcard games where they only play 5 innings. They'll just be like, okay, listen, we gotta get this going. 5 innings, and then let's switch around. So
like in the minor leagues where they play 7 inning doubleheaders.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's wrap up. This is the last All-Star game for Bud Selig, who has been the commissioner for 20 plus years, and apparently, he claims it's the last one. I actually tend to believe him this time. Of course, so much among a large contingent of the populace, particularly in the non-baseball fan variety, the lasting image of Selig will be looking befuddled at the Milwaukee All-Star game, which has led us to me being... I will confess, when my team is good, I get much more invested in whether the All-Star and who wins the All-Star game. It's stupid, but because it matters. Like, I always think how different 2011 would have been if Prince Fielder had not homered in the All-Star game that year, and they're playing those games in Texas rather than in St. Louis. But, when you look back at Selig, and all he's done, certainly it's impossible to deny the financial windfalls he's brought onto the game, some of which he can take credit for, and some of which probably would have happened anyway. But it's people get very obsessed with Selig's legacy, and it's funny. And I'm, to me, the reason the stuff that Selig does that I like, and the stuff, the difference between the stuff that I like and stuff that he does that he doesn't like, comes down to this fundamental thing. And I'm curious what you think of, think about it. It seems to me that he believes that the biggest black mark on his legacy is PEDs. And for me, it seems quite obvious that the biggest black mark on the legacy is that they canceled the goddamn World Series. And to me, that speaks well to him moving forward, that there appears to be, even if it is sometimes at the detriment to the players, there appears to be labor peace now in a way that that wasn't 20 years ago. So for me, as long as that keeps going, as long as, to me, labor peace has always been more important than the PED things, and sometimes Selig seems to think that the PED things is a bigger deal. I'm curious, what do you think Seed will be remembered by, and what do you think he should be remembered by?
It's almost like he gets a pass for 94 in some place because he wasn't technically commissioner yet. He was commissioner in waiting or just the head of the. I'm not sure when he became. I guess he was commissioner in waiting, but there was that. He was really the owner's lead negotiator at that point. I'm with you. I think that you don't get around canceling a World Series. He canceled the World Series. More what I would say is being behind a labor strategy that forced the cancellation of the World
Right,
Series.
right, right.
At any point, the owners could have agreed to a no-strike, no-lockout pledge. The players went out on strike in 1994 because they knew the owners were going to lock them out in 1995. There was no question. I mean, for people who didn't live through this, I can just tell you that the owners were going, if there was no agreement on, at that point, a payroll cap, the owners were going to lock the players out in 95. And so the only leverage the players had was to strike in August of 94. It was a perfectly legitimate labor strategy. And, the owners back then wanted a payroll cap because, everybody else had one by breaking the agreement. This was in the wake of, the NBA owners opening their books in 82 and getting a payroll cap in the wake of the 80 member. This was only 7 years after the NFL broke its union by using replacement players. We weren't that far removed from that kind of environment. The other thing that I come up with is, for the first 8, 9 years of Selig's time in office, he would trash the game. His whole thing was, oh, only 5 or 6 teams. Nobody has hope and faith. Only 5 or 6 teams can win. I don't know why you people are going to baseball games. His whole thing was trashing baseball, anti-marketing of the game, culminating 3 days after, it might have even been like one day, after this incredible World Series in 2001, in the wake of what had happened just 2 months before that World Series. Selig stepping to a podium and saying, we're going to eliminate 2 teams. Baseball had all of this momentum. And Selig's solution to that was to go and say, well, we have to eliminate 2 teams. And that, to me, just underlines how much of Bud Selig's time in office has been spent trashing baseball. A lot of what happened prior to, I guess, what we might call the public PED era has kind of been forgotten. And I get that. I mean, a lot of people watching baseball now, 94 is ancient history. Even 2001 is ancient history. Guys like you and me are going to remember that stuff. And guys like you and me are going to judge Selig based on that stuff. Now, PEDs, look, it's just not that big an issue for me. I get that there are people who get wrapped up in it, but I've looked at the numbers. And you really can't find the PEDs in the numbers. And I'm sorry, I know people are going to roll their eyes. I can hear the eyes roll as people download this and listen to this. But if you look at the league-wide numbers, you can't find it. There's a 4-year period from 98 to 2001 that is actually more explained by the double expansion and by changes in equipment in ballparks and strike zones than it is by, the whole league discovered PEDs. And if you go back to 93, it's the same thing. It's not like everybody got a shipment in the winter of 1992 and started shooting up. You can't find PEDs in the numbers. And at the individual level, there's the big boogie monsters. Sosa, I don't even want to put Sammy Sosa in this because, other than, a rumored,
right,
reported leaked memo, there's really nothing connecting Sosa to PEDs. But, McGuire confessed, Barry Bonds, there was a book. The big boogie monsters. But there are an awful lot of guys like Bobby Estella and God, I'm going to forget the usual example. Nobody talks about Alex Sanchez's PED record.
Or Ryan Franklin.
Nobody talks about dozens of pitchers who've been caught.
Right, Ryan Franklin is the example I always follow, but he doesn't even throw hard.
You can't find PEDs in the connection. Like I say, there's a huge gap between the way the public sees this issue and the way I see this. And I'm perfectly fine with that, and I'll go to my grave saying, I think I've got it more right than the public does. Not to say that players using these substances should be lionized, but we look the other way on amphetamine use, and I can find a lot more evidence of amphetamine use in the playing record than I can steroid use. For years, we looked the other way on drugs, and then in 2002, we decided that we were going to get mad about this because Barry Bonds broke the home run record. And Bud Selig, who'd been an owner through the cocaine years, hey, Milwaukee Brewers, did they have any cocaine users? And who basically said he had no idea, who's an owner who said he had no idea about this stuff, who's a commissioner who said he had no idea about this stuff for years, suddenly decided that, this was the biggest issue facing the game. And it ties into labor relations because it coincides with the players losing all of their strength as a union. PEDs split the union. It divided the union between players who, frankly, the majority, probably wouldn't consider using these substances, and a minority of some size that probably did. And since then, the union's basically broken as an effective bargaining union. This is important because, I apologize again, the negotiations that have subsequently happened between the players and the owners have largely focused on how can we punish you more, how can we test you more, and not on the money issues.
Right.
So the players are getting their brains beat on the money issues while trying to defend themselves from being the cheating cheaters who cheated. We've spent 10 years now. Bud Selig found a winning strategy. Paint the players as the cheating cheaters who cheated and ignore, just don't talk about anything else. So, and that's how you end up with a witch hunt of, buying stolen documents from a criminal to suspend a player for a year. And I know there are people who think Bud Selig is a hero for that, but I can't look at that as a positive in his legacy. So for me, I see all the bad. And is there good? There are people who love the wild card. There are people who love realignment. There are people who love interleague play. I look at interleague play and say, okay, you've got 162 games, and you're trying to play 20 opponents. This is why you end up with six-hour rain delays and games being played in monsoons on fields that are completely unplayable because we're trying to force too many opponents into a 162-game schedule because Bud Selig wants the Yankees and Mets to play on ESPN. The biggest defense of Bud Selig you can make is revenue growth, right?
I always find whenever I defend Selig, I always sound a little Ayn Randian. I always sound a little like, listen, I want the game to survive, and so therefore it needs to have a lot of money and go. And that is, I feel like that's something that has undeniably been done. Which is fine because to me, like the positive side of his legacy is that kind of labor peace, even though it's kind of been done on the backs of the players.
Well, first of all, it hasn't been labor peace for 19 years. There hasn't been a stoppage in 19 years, right. 20 years now. But 2002 was not labor peace.
Right. It was close.
The players were set to go on strike, for one. And for two, it was nasty.
Yeah.
The owners, I don't want to say the owners ever went and said, how can these guys do it in the wake of September 11th? But that was the owner's mouthpieces were very much using September 11th against the players. It was as nasty a labor fight as you're going to have. Subsequent to 2002, everything's been done in this context of PEDs. The players have basically been cowed on that issue and have had no ability to sustain a negotiation on other issues. So, yeah, it's peace. But, I don't know that you can look at the last 10 years where the players have now been asked to give up urine, been asked to give up blood. Frankly, I don't think the players have gotten anything for that. Because every time somebody hits 22 home runs in 2 months, we have to hear about how they might be using PEDs. Ask Chris Davis if the drug testing did anything for him. Ask Jose Bautista if the drug testing has really done anything for him. It's all about reputation, right? It's a prove your innocence program. But no matter how much these players prove their innocence, it's going to be somebody saying, well, they're just using stuff that can't be detected. I don't know what we've gained through a drug testing program. Anyway, that's where we are now. And yeah, labor peace. Sure, let's see what happens in 2016, 2017, whenever they reopen the CBA. The biggest thing about Selig is this. The greatest successes the baseball successes have been labor peace, we just talked about that, and revenue. Okay. The biggest drivers in the increase in baseball revenue are the following. Not in order. New stadiums, cable television, MLB Advanced Media. I don't think the new stadiums, I can't give him credit for that because I think it's a disgusting process. I think if you look at the way some of these new stadiums have been built, the processes, the voting, the politics that have gone into it, it would make you wretch. You know, guys like Dave Zirin and Neil DeMoss have covered this extensively. But I cannot see this as a net positive for Bud Selig when it's such a net negative for all of the communities that build these stadiums. So, yes, it's meant more money for Major League Baseball, but I can't defend the process by which the Marlins got a stadium. I can't defend the process of Safeco Field or Miller Park. I cannot give the man credit for something that is such a net public policy negative. And for things, frankly, that have just been just this side of criminal and how they've come about. That's one. Cable television. I can't give Bud Selig credit for things he has absolutely nothing to do with. You know, technology. It's like giving Bud Selig credit for Netflix. Because of Netflix, people aren't watching television anymore. The only television they're watching is live sports. That's why the Dodgers can get $70 billion for their TV rights, and the Angels, and the Rangers, and the Phillies, and the Yankees. Regional sports networks. Bud Selig didn't come up with that. I mean, it's turning Bud Selig into Forrest Gump, the guy who happened to be standing there when all of these other things happened. Again, I can't give him credit for things he had literally nothing to do with. And the third thing being MLB Advanced Media. That's Bob Ullman. That's Bob Ullman and technology happening that allowed MLB.TV to become the greatest app in history. Bud Selig, didn't he famously say he's never sent an email?
No, for the
sure,
record. No,
let's give him credit for MLB.TV. Let's do that.
Okay.
So the three drivers of revenue are bad public, you know, stadium extortion, being the guy standing there when cable sports became the only thing people would watch live, and MLB Advanced Media, which was basically, okay, Bob Bowman, go do great things for me. I'm sorry, I can't put the I put that up against all of the bad, the first 10 years, the you know, and even before Selig was commissioner, and maybe again this is unfair, he drove collusion. Collusion created the 94 strike. It also created the two expansions in the 90s, which created the home run scare, which created the PED scare. I mean, this is a lot for a podcast, but you know, collusion is a large part of why we ended up where we ended up in 2005. So, I'm sorry. Bud Selig is going to the Hall of Fame. I've accepted that. But the idea that Bud Selig has been this, you know, spent the last 10 years being unalloyed good, chasing PEDs out of the game, you know, being there when revenues went through the roof, there's just this whole, you really, once you look at the details, to me it all falls apart.
All right, well, okay, Mr. I know my history, and I've been following this for a long time, and your facts.
I'm old, Will.
I'm getting there, man. All right, this has been a pleasure as always, sir.
Wait. You just let me rant for 10 minutes. You got to say something.
No, I mean, listen.
Either I've turned you, I haven't turned you. What do
you
have? Come on, give me something.
I think it's when it comes. I will speak specifically to the revenue. I think revenue wise, I feel like, generally speaking, this is how American finance works. The people that are in charge get credit for things that happen when they're in charge.
That's true.
And I feel like I mean, those people that are all making them, Bob Bowman's making that money. But Bud Selig's his boss, and I feel like, you know, there's a lot of things there. I feel like Selig has shown that revenue. Maybe we can't give him a lot of credit. Maybe you can or you cannot give him a lot of credit for these things specifically. He's certainly made the argument. He's never made it. He never denied the fact that a lot of this is about money, man. We're doing this stuff about money. And oh, look, there's a bunch of money in the game now. Like I feel like if you have someone. The way we used to have commissioners, like a Uberoth, for example, where they were considered these custodians of the game, then maybe a lot of this revenue stuff doesn't come. You know, I think that he put that as a priority, and maybe he didn't specifically come up with the genius things that have made this, but certainly he was in charge when they happened, And I think it's telling that when we look at the next commissioner, no one's saying, "Hey, we should have Bob Costas be commissioner." Like no one does that anymore. George will, or you know, or hopefully not George will. But you know, they're used, before Selig, there was this idea, and maybe it was probably better for the game, maybe better for the players anyway, that there would be. You know, this steward of the game, take care of the game, be careful, be this mediator. I remember Donald Fehr talking about this, saying, you know, one of the things I like about negotiating with Selig is there's no longer this illusion that the guy's not working completely with the owners. And saying that, like, because he would get frustrated negotiating with people that were like, hey, listen, I'm impartial here. I don't care who wins. I just want the game to be happy. And seems to be like, you know, I work for the owners, and we're getting this together. He always kind of appreciated having that adversary who knew where he was coming from, and where Seathic was coming from was to make money for the game. And
Absolutely.
sometimes there are things that I don't like, and sometimes there. But at the end of the day, my feeling on this is always, I just don't want humans to screw up baseball. That's literally exactly how I feel about all of these. Please don't screw up baseball, humans. And so if there are things that Selig has done that I don't agree with, I think the PED stuff is way over the top. I feel like the A-Rod thing is really all the it's I'd see Fishman, who wrote the New York Magazine story on this podcast when that story came out, and it's really just gross, really, the whole thing is. So certainly, I do not think that you're wrong with the PED stuff and that kind of using as kind of this hedge against players. But I do think it's a little unfair to say that these things just happen to happen occur while Selig was in charge. I mean, but Selig is whatever your thoughts about him, the game is financially in a far better place from a guy who has constantly said, I want this game to make more money. And I think Forrest Gump is it, I don't know if I buy it, just because I feel like anyone that's I don't spend a lot of, you know, of course MLB Advance Media is part owner of Sports on Earth. I don't really spend a lot of time in those offices. But when I'm there, I'll say that, like, people they understand that it's their job to make money. Like, you know, I think that and that's got to come from somewhere, and that's got to come from the top. I don't feel
And
like, okay, sorry, go ahead.
honestly, I'm fine with it. I think that then your evaluation of SEAL, independent of PEDs, independent of the strike and collusion and all that, is really going to come down to how much credit are you giving him for the revenue growth. And I say, I've laid out the argument that I have a hard time connecting him specifically to a large, he shouldn't get a lot of the credit for it. And you're kind of saying you get more credit for it. I think that's the central argument here. How much credit does Bud Selig deserve for where baseball is financially right now? And I think that in the end, and even like say, I think that everything else is pretty black and white. You know, these were bad things that Bud Selig did. And it comes down to how much credit is he going to get for where the game is now? That's where the argument's going to lie. That's really going to be the battleground for Selig's legacy. It's not going to be any of this other stuff. It's going to be how much of that money should he get credit for? And whether if it is enough, if it is a lot of credit, it probably can't settle out of the other stuff. And if it's not, it doesn't.
Well, you know what's going to happen, and we'll wrap up with this, is whoever takes over, if it's Rob Manfred or whoever, what's going to happen is that cable bubble, it's going to pop, because it has to at some point. It just literally has to
You've said
happen.
this a number of times.
Like, it has to happen. It doesn't make sense. As I always say, my friend Aileen, she's so furious. She's like, well, I pay like $10 a month for ESPN, and I don't even know where it is. Like, there are too many people that don't care about sports paying a ton of money. Like, that spigot has to be turned off at some point, or at least, you know, turned down. And when that happens, I feel like there's a lot of money, not just in baseball, but in sports, that's going to go away. And so, in other words, whoever takes over, when that happens, they're going to end up getting blamed for that. Like, they didn't see this coming. And then we're all going to talk about, like, you know, I remember the good old days, back when baseball was making money, back when Bud Selig was in charge. And we're going to see that in the next 15 years. So, history, the point is, history is always a moving target. And whenever we discuss these things, right now we'll say no, Matt. I'll put it this way: that I don't think when Ronald Reagan or Bill Clinton were leaving office, everyone was like, "Man, we just lost a how we'll never get back to these good old days again." And now everyone just talks about how great things were when Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton were in office. So I feel like eventually, no matter what happens, we'll look back at it positively because in the future lies chaos.
Yes.
All right. Thanks, man. Thanks for doing this. Always, this has been a great time. Now, what we're gonna do is right now, I'm gonna pretend that I'm not talking to you anymore after this, and we're gonna do trivia, and trivia will run the rest of the week. But for now, the interview part of this, Joe, thanks for doing this. I've had a great time as always. I appreciate it, and hang on, and we'll do some trivia.
Sounds good, Will. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks to Joe Sheehan. You can follow him on Twitter at Joe underscore Sheehan, Joe underscore Sheehan. This has been the Willish Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sundogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes. We will be back Tuesday through Friday as I put Joe through the trivia ringer. Take care and see you tomorrow.